So tonight I'd like to offer some reflections on gateways to peace and freedom, very much from the teachings of the Buddha, but maybe even, well, I'll let you be the judge, but as much from my own experience and the truth of my experience. One of the things the Buddha said was, don't believe anything or take it for truth just because you hear it, to check it out with your own experience. So this talk very much comes from my own experience, and I offer it to you as a reflection and as something that has been of great support to me, and perhaps you will find it, some kernels of it, to be of support to you. One of the both strange and wondrous things of meditation and a retreat is how the presence of calmness and quiet and mindfulness and the lack of distraction can reveal or illuminate, shine a light on places of struggle and fear and doubt and anger and resistance and holding. All these things that probably have been present but just not seen or felt or recognized. It's a little bit like here we are, and it's like seeing the tip of the tail of a sea monster. The tip of it looks benign. It looks harmless. You can mistake it for a rock or a plant growing out of a pond, out of the sea. And then all of a sudden, the sea becomes very calm. And in the calmness comes the clarity of the water, of what you can see beneath the water. And there lurks a huge sea monster. So we can see the depth and the hugeness of the body. And then there are all the layers to seeing that, to seeing how big this monster is lurking beneath the surface. The layers of reaction to meeting with it, and the fear and the resistance and the aversion. And sometimes I think that with the clarity and the calmness of the sea, that maybe the monster sees me too. And it emerges to show itself in full strength and full color. And a common reaction to confronting what looks like danger, what feels like danger, are the classic responses of fight or flight. So fight being perhaps justifying in the mind, defending, arguing, restlessness, agitation. So all of these reactions to our personal sea monsters, these can show. This is the fight reflex. Or maybe for some of us, at times, the flight reflex shows itself. The avoidance, the denial, the seeking distraction, the effort to push it under the water again, just not wanting to meet it, not wanting to open to it. And another reflex, which I think is part of this flight, this avoidance, can be, not always, but can be a kind of determined effort to be steady and concentrated with every breath, with every sensation. Because concentration can be a way of distracting ourselves or avoiding discomfort. And this effort, this concentration, can show itself at times, not always. It can be manifesting as pain in the body, as a headache, as a neck ache, shoulder ache, back ache, stomach ache. And it also can show itself as dullness and sleepiness. So some of these reactions from intensity of resistance or just part of the avoidance. So seeing how the mind and body are so intricately and intimately connected. There can also be self-judging about it. Oh, I shouldn't have reacted that way. There can be self-criticism. As Norman has expressed, the finger can be pointed outward with anger and hatred at the sea monster, at somebody who might be related to the sea monster or part of the life of the sea monster. There can be self-doubt, self-anger, self-hatred, and despair. And then we can hook into, just watch the mind spin out and select memories that reinforce my view of it or project into the future. This is how, you know, I'm going to have to deal with the sea monster forever. You know, look, he's out here, he's scaring me, he's going to follow me home. Help. So I think for each of us, we all have a familiar pattern of response. I see it in myself incredibly. I recently sat a long retreat, and I got so familiar with what my habitual response was to perceived danger, you know, on very subtle levels as well as very big levels. And actually, it can be wonderful when you notice that, because then you can really get to know it and know that it's just a habit. So these patterns of response, they're often a dance around the dukkha, around the sea monster, around the thought, around the emotion. It can be a dance around it, or also it can be a dance away from it. And this determined effort, this busyness of the dance, can really result in anguish. It's a lot of energy and effort, seen and unseen, that is required to perpetuate this dance. And that the anguish can be mental and it can be in the body. It can be projected out and blamed on others. Or just the energy of the negativity or the fear or the insecurity can kind of ooze out and affects behavior, our behavior in relationship to everything and everybody else. It's kind of like these mind states. Somebody spills a red dye over everything, and so we're looking at everything through this filter. How exhausting. And how many more layers of dukkha, of reaction, of suffering, does it add to the initial thought, the initial emotion, the initial encounter with the monster? And in the process of doing this dance of reaction or manipulation or avoidance, how much mindfulness of the present moment is present? How involved with the story or the avoidance are we? And what happens to the mindfulness? It's as if the attention gets hijacked by these emotions. And my story becomes the world. The phrase self-centered takes on real meaning. I think it takes over. My story, the self-centeredness, the focus on self takes over. And we get really stuck, you know, holding on to my view of things, holding on to it and holding on to my problem. And with this can grow, I think, a real sense of isolation, of feeling separate from everything else and everyone else. And then there's no ability to respond to others, to the environment, because my heart and mind, they're not open, they're not aware. They're locked into a groove, a pattern of behavior, of this kind of response behavior. And so, really importantly, this way of being, this identifying with and taking up this delusion of me and my story, this is who I am, this not only affects me, this mind and this body and this heart, but also those around me. The fact that situations like this do cause so much pain and command our attention actually has the potential to be a very good thing. When we're happy and enjoying ourselves, when the senses are full of pleasure and delight, how mindful are we? How much intention can we muster? Isn't it usually after the pleasure, when we suffer the effects perhaps of too much pleasure or indulgence or delusion, that the impermanent nature shows itself and we're aware conditions have changed and now it's not so pleasant? Doesn't that catch our attention? Doesn't that make us much more mindful? And so here we are on retreat. Most of us, I think, fighting or fleeing, or trying to fight, or trying to flee our own monsters, either on the inner level or the outer level. And the suffering is so clear and so obvious, and it's really touched Norman's and my heart to hold the space with you and to bear witness with you to the struggles, to the suffering. It's very, very present here on this retreat. So perhaps now is when there is or there can be a willingness to explore and to reflect and to open to a different way to be with it. A willingness to open to courage. And I don't mean a macho kind of courage. It's not a grit your teeth, clench your fist kind of I'm going to get through this kind of courage. It's very interesting that the word courage has its root in the word heart. The French word for heart is, pardon my French, cœur, C-O-E-U-R. And that's where the word courage comes from. So it's a very heartful thing. And I think calling for courage, it's the courage to bear witness to the dukkha even in the fear. And also perhaps now there's a willingness to open to patience. patience as a gentle standing, kind of holding hands with just this moment and this moment and this moment, without any expectation or any need for the outcome to be any way. It's very, very, patience is in this moment. It's of the present. And patience is one of the things that appears very often on those wonderful lists of the Buddha as a very important quality to cultivate. And another one being intention, which we've touched on before. And here meaning the intention to let the first noble truth come alive in my practice. So to recognize, as Norman was speaking of last night, yes, recognize, yes, this is dukkha. This is suffering. This is pain. This is stress. This is unreliability. And to meet it. To meet the monster, or what feels like a monster. And in the meeting of it, asking, what is this I'm calling monster? And going into body to meet it, to experience it, to feel the depth and breadth and color and sensation. Just where is it showing? Where is it living in this body? Allowing it to have its life. So important. Just giving it the space to have its life. And I think it's important to remember the first precept that we talked about on the first evening of not killing. Because this also refers to an attitude of mind towards the mind. So therefore, to allow whatever is showing that feels painful to have its life, but with an attitude of kindness towards it, not one of making demands or trying to beat it up, just making peace with it. It makes me think of an angry bull. Do you know what a bull is? Okay, good, good. And when you try to fence in, enclose a bull that's full of rage, that's fighting, what happens? It gets angrier. It gets desperate. It kicks and froths at the mouth, and you don't want to go near that. But if you put this bull out into a pasture, a big wide open space, and just let it be, it'll kick a few times, and then it'll get interested in the grass or the daisies, and it'll munch away and just sit down and enjoy himself in the sunshine, not bothering anybody. And mind can be like this too. You know, we try to fence it in and be the boss, it'll show us. But if we can make peace with it and give it some space, just notice, maybe it too can just come to rest. So the more demands we make on the thoughts and the emotions and the monsters to change or to leave, the stronger they seem to get. But without resistance, without contraction, without avoidance, they have their life and, like all things, change and pass away. A wonderful, wonderful Zen teacher in America, Reb Anderson, said in one of his books, if you face your pain and ignorance uprightly, tenderly, and respectfully, then the truth will be revealed. And that's what we're here to discover, to be awake to. And to know that at times, to face dukkha tenderly and respectfully means to give it space. At times, it means to go for a walk and to have a cup of tea. To do what nourishes the heart, because the heart may need tending and healing before it can fully face suffering. To know there's no formula. What Norman and I and the Buddha offer are just tools and techniques. And ultimately, you've got to check in with yourself. What's the wise path at any moment? And sometimes we only know what isn't wise because we can feel it. And then there's just being with not knowing, being with some confusion for a while. And maybe that's what the helpful thing is to do, just to be with not knowing. And sometimes in the wisdom of a moment of mindfulness and calmness, what feels like dukkha can transform into understanding. Understanding and insight can just show itself. It can be revealed so unexpectedly. Old habits of behavior and perception can transform into new ways of being. And one of the beautiful things about being on retreat in the silence and in the stillness is then we can see it when it happens. We can recognize it, and we can nourish that. So bringing awareness and also bringing this factor, this quality of interest, that's another one on the Buddha's lists of really important qualities to cultivate. Bring this factor of interest to the body, to experience it and see and know the truth of thoughts and emotions and sensations. And the dukkha and the monster often just goes up in smoke. But it does that, it goes through change or it passes away in its own time. And this is so important. Just as it arose codependently with other conditions, on the coming together of other things, so it will pass away dependent on many, many conditions, not in our control. So if we really know and understand this co-arising and co-passing away, the emotion, the thought, the monster can lose credibility. It can lose power and authority because we see it's not me, it's arising because of and with so many, so many factors. Some that we know of, some that are in the present, some that are in the past, and some that don't seem to have the remotest connection with ourselves, and some that we don't even see or know at all. So the paying attention to body, sometimes just the physical sensations remind me that something's been touched, that there's some discomfort. And it sort of is a red light, pay attention, pay attention. And the mindfulness can get clear. And it can be a reminder, those sensations can be a reminder not to get involved with the story and with the reactions. So those sensations can be a friend, as well as the emotion itself, the monster itself, because that too wakes us up. It wakes us up to seeing unskillful action and the result of unskillful action. And it offers an opportunity for compassion, for clear seeing, for wise action, and for freedom. So how to be with these monsters? How to be with difficult thoughts and emotion that affect us so strongly and so deeply, and how to transform them into practice and into wisdom. So the Buddha offered countless suggestions, and a couple of them I'd like to talk about tonight. So as I've said tonight, and as Norman has said, as much as possible and as soon as possible, to turn the attention away from the story, from the past associations and the future fears, and open to the present moment, which is revealed in this body. Making no demands, having no hidden agendas, and no expectations. And just floating the question, what is this I'm calling anger, or fear, or shame? Floating the question without needing an answer, asking it of the body. There doesn't have to be the added layer of fear of the fear, or sadness at the sadness, or anger towards the anger, or shame of the shame. Can it just be fear fearing? Just fear being itself. Fear fears. Anger angers. Shame shames. Sadness saddens. Another beautiful few words from Reb Anderson. But there is something that remains unmoved in the midst of the comings and goings of our happiness and our sufferings. Something completely still, silent, and at peace right under our noses. So while sitting still, please listen to the body. I'm suggesting this as a way to realize peace in the midst of suffering. Listen to the body. But often, as I think many of us have experienced this week, the mind can be stubborn. It can be fixed. It can be hardened into old habits. And views and opinions and these habits die hard. And sometimes the heart just seems to close down in frustration and self-aversion and giving up as a way of dealing with too much pain. And what can be helpful is finding a way or letting a way be seen where the heart and the mind and even the body can soften. And there's a practice in the tradition called the Brahma Viharas that have that intention to soften and heal the heart. So Brahma means divine in the Pali language, in the language of the Buddha. And Vihara is a dwelling place, a place to rest. So Brahma Vihara basically means divine abiding, a divine resting place. And there are four Brahma Vihara practices that incline the heart, that encourage the heart and mind to dwell in the first one being metta. And Norman did the metta practice this afternoon. So the first Brahma Vihara is the metta, to encourage the heart to soften and to dwell in friendliness, caring, kindness to all beings. And the second inclines the heart to dwell in compassion. And the Pali word for that is karuna. And compassion is really metta for suffering. And the third is appreciative joy. And the Pali word is mudita. So it's encouraging opening to the joy of appreciation for things in my own life and in the life of others. And when we open to the joy of others, it's called sympathetic joy. And then the fourth is abiding in equanimity, a practice to encourage abiding in equanimity, in upekkha, in steadiness with how things are. So Norman already introduced the metta practice, so I'll just say a little bit about that. And it can be a wonderful antidote for aversion, for anger. If one is caught up in anger or pain or fear or despair, then try the metta practice to wish yourself well. And it can be helpful to soften anger towards another person, wishing both myself and the other person well and happiness and peace. And it can also be used as a forgiveness practice. And I have found this to be really, really wonderful. It can really soften that judgmental and critical voice. And for the forgiveness practice, you can use the words, "May I be forgiven for my thoughts and words and actions that have hurt or harmed others. May I forgive myself for the thoughts and words and actions that have caused me pain or harm." And then, as much as possible, very gently, may I forgive others for their words, thoughts, and actions that have hurt or harmed me. So with any of the Brahmaviharas, there are certain phrases that I'll share with you tonight, or it's perfectly acceptable and quite wonderful to make up your own phrases that feel right in any given moment or situation. And with all of them, try to keep the phrases short and simple, and it's best to have no more than four. Because you're going to repeat them for each person that you're wishing them for. Keep the attention in the heart as you say the words silently to yourself. And some people like to visualize the person that they're sending the metta or the compassion to, even oneself. And sometimes it's easier if you think of that person as a child. If you find it difficult to send metta to yourself, imagine yourself as a child or someone that you're quite angry at. It might be easier to connect with them as a child rather than a big adult. So with metta, the tradition is to start with someone it's easy to open the heart with. So traditionally, that can be sending metta to oneself or to a loved one. And then if it's difficult sending to yourself, then start first with the loved one. And then move on to a neutral person, to a stranger, someone you don't really, really know. And then to someone that you've had some difficulty with. And best not to start with someone that you've had a lot of difficulty with. And important to know that doing metta, it's not saying, "I approve of your actions." Not at all. It's just encouraging the heart to open to all beings, regardless of how I feel about them. Acknowledging, "I want to be happy, and so do all beings." So I think Norman gave you some beautiful examples of metta. And just using phrases to wish kindness, to connect with kindness, to connect with friendliness, these qualities that really warm the heart, that nourish us, and that can be so healing. There's the wish with all of these that not only are they touching and healing my own heart, but that the wish will in fact touch the hearts of others. And there are many studies, very current scientific studies, that are showing the truth in this, that have shown that the power of prayer and the power of doing metta really can have an effect on people we don't know and who are very far away. So it can be a very powerful practice. So the compassion practice, the metta for suffering. And this is to soften the heart when it's full of pain for one's own suffering, or full of pain with the suffering of others. And it can be pain on an individual level or for a whole group of people. It can be a real healing for despair or burnout or helplessness. So it cultivates connection rather than closing the heart and closing the mind when there's just been too much. It really encourages us not to close off, but to open and to allow a wise response to come. So some compassion phrases could be, may I open to this pain, or may I open to this struggle with kindness. May I live with an open heart. May I, or may you, or may all beings be free from pain or struggle. May I or you be free from fear or despair. May I, may you be at peace. And I think one of the most important aspects of the meditation on compassion is how it cultivates these qualities of connection in a non-exclusive way. It's not, I want to respond just to you or to you, but it's cultivating a heart that connects with all beings, regardless of how I may feel about them. Acknowledging, just as I want to be free from suffering and from pain, so do all beings. And to know that it's an intention, not a demand. It's inclining the heart towards. It's not saying, this is how I should be right now. This is practice, practice, practice. The mudita practice, the appreciative joy, balances the sadness of suffering, balances the compassion by encouraging our opening to appreciation, to feeling joy in each other's happiness and appreciating our own happiness. And I know one time when I was doing mudita practice and following the usual order, and starting with myself, I couldn't do it. The heart I just couldn't open the heart enough to connect with my own happiness. And sometimes it can really trigger a feeling of unworthiness or of guilt. And so it may be helpful first to connect with the happiness of someone else, someone who you very easily connect with and who you can see just seems to radiate happiness, and just to, in wishing them well and just holding their happiness, it can really touch one's own heart. And so it can be, for example, just appreciation for everyone here. supporting my practice, supporting each other's practice, and just feel appreciation for that. It can be as simple as that. Some of the phrases, may your happiness continue, may it increase and never end, or may your appreciation of life or your good fortune continue, may it increase and never end. And when you then start to try to offer mudita, these phrases for yourself, may my happiness continue, may it increase and never end. If you feel the heart contract with that, maybe begin by doing some metta or some compassion practice first. May I open to this pain with gentleness and kindness. May I be accepting of myself. And let that be the beginning. And then if there's some steadiness, if the heart can open a bit, then to really take some time and connect with how there is happiness and how there are things to appreciate in my life right now, even though there may also be suffering. And if it's hard to connect with it in the present, then try to remember times in the past where there has been happiness, where there has been things that I really appreciate. And allow the heart to really dwell with that as you say the phrases. And that's true with all of them. In feeling compassion, allow yourself to really hold yourself in the heart or hold the others you're sending compassion to. And the same with the metta. And the same with the equanimity. So that it's not a thought thing, but an experience thing, so that it really can touch the heart and help to heal the heart. And the equanimity practice balances the other three Brahma Viharas. It asks us to be steady with life just as it is, regardless of our good wishes, regardless of our good intentions, regardless of outcome. We wish all this for ourselves and for others, and then we have to just accept how life unfolds. And that can be really painful. If we're wishing something good for someone or for someone to heal, and life unfolds in a different way, we do the best we can. We offer whatever we can, and then just release it as best we can. It really acknowledges that we are not in control. And that can be very, very difficult. So the equanimity phrases can be helpful when dealing with one's own challenges and difficulties and reactions, and also when dealing with the reactions of others or the pain of others. And some of the phrases that may be helpful, may I or you or all beings be steady with how things are. And it may take time and practice for this to grow. So perhaps, may I trust in the unfolding of life, or may I open to trust. These might be helpful too. But from a place of equanimity, even in conditions of turbulence and agitation and violence and loss and great fear, the mind and body and heart can be steady and responsive. It can access clear wisdom and compassion and does not have to get caught up in view. It doesn't have to get caught up in defending or protecting or fighting. And it's on the Buddha's list of the factors for awakening. Equanimity is a factor for liberation. And how essential it is for those of us who so deeply long for peace. So may these practices ease your way. And may the dukkha that may be present in these days together so strongly be a gateway to understanding and to heartfulness and to peace. So let's just sit for a few moments together.